It is indeed a pleasure and honor today to introduce to you a great church leader, an alumnus, and a very loyal alumnus, distinguished alumnus of Ricks College, and a wonderful friend, Elder J. Richard Clark. He is very familiar with Ricks College. He was born and raised in Rexburg. And he played on the college's basketball team as a student here. During his second year as a student at Ricks, he met his wife, the former Barbara Jean Reed of Ryrie. He also served as sophomore class president and was a member of Delta Phi fraternity after serving a mission in South Africa. Enrollment at Ricks has become a family tradition for the Clarks, as seven of their eight children have attended. The only exception was a daughter who was deceased at age 11. Elder Clark went on to Brigham Young University, where he graduated in marketing. He was later general manager for five states for the Mutual Life Insurance Company of New York. He has been involved with youth organizations and has been active in community service. He has been affiliated with many national and university professional management organizations. He received the Outstanding Alumnus Award from Ricks College in 1973 and has also been named the Business Leader of the Year by Ricks. He was sustained as second counselor in the presiding bishopric in 1976. At the time, he and his family were living in Boise. In 1985, he became a member of the First Quorum of the 70 and returned to Africa to serve as president of the South Africa Cape Town Mission. For the past several years, he has served as a member of the presidency of the Quorums of 70. He is currently executive director of the Family History Department. His first plane that he was coming on today was canceled after he got on it, I believe. And we were all wondering again if, with another great athlete coming to Ricks, would have a repeat of Dale Murphy's arrival today. He made it just a few minutes earlier. We're honored to have with us today Elder J. Richard Clark.
Considering the fact that I had to come in on two different airplanes, and the last plane I didn't know if we were going to be able to land because we had to keep circling around before receiving permission. So when I tell you that I'm glad to be here, you've got to realize there's a little bit of an extra dimension of sincerity in that statement. I'm glad to be anywhere. Besides being up in the air in an airplane today, it is wonderful to be home. My roots are deep in this East Idaho soil. And I hope that my preparation will be acceptable to you and to our Heavenly Father, whom I serve. It's very, very important that we're on the same channel. It's important that we're connected so that we can communicate for a little while together. You have a reputation of being one of the greatest audiences that we as general authorities ever address. As we've talked about it from time to time, each one says the same thing, that to come to Ricks College is a very sweet experience, and we appreciate the inspiration that you provide for the speakers who come here as your guests. When I say it's important that we be connected, I'm reminded of a story some years ago. A lady called a record shop, at least she thought she did. But rather than connecting with the record shop, she reached a private residence, and a man answered the telephone, and she said, "Do you have eyes of blue and a love supreme?" And there was a pause. And he says, "No," but he said, "I have a wife and 11 children." She said, "Is that a record?" And he said, "I don't suppose it is, but it's as close to it as I'm going to get." So I hope that we really can communicate. As was mentioned, I'm the executive director of the Family History Department. I've never had an assignment that is any more exciting to me than that, and I don't suppose I ever thought that I'd ever say that, but it really is. The day and time in which we live is such a remarkable time, and when you see what is happening, how the Lord has prepared people, what a great blessing it is to be living at this time. Now, to many people, family history is a dead subject. To me, it's totally exciting. And also humorous. The children of the head of a prominent family decided to give him a book of their family history. And the biographer they hired for the job was warned about one problem. Uncle Willie, the black sheep, who had gone to the electric chair for murder. And the biographer promised that he could handle his situation. He said, "I'll just say that Uncle Willie occupied a chair of applied electronics in one of our leading financial or government institutions." I said, he was attached to his position by the strongest of ties, and his death came as a tremendous shock. So you can cover most any situation if you're skillful enough. I'd like to share with you an excerpt or two from some of the letters we receive in our department, if you don't think family history is a live subject. These are just excerpts. "I've looked for Grandpa for over 20 years. Do you have him in your library?" "I guess I got too excited." This is another one. "I guess I got too excited over finding my great-grandmother, and now I've lost her. Will you please send me a copy?" Another one. "Enclosed, please find my grandmother. I've worked on her for 50 years without success. Now let's see what you can do." "I've always thought I was the only member of my family." Now, these are listed as unusual causes for death on a number of death certificates that we've looked at. Unusual causes of death. First, died suddenly, nothing serious. Cause of death, don't know, have never been fatally ill before. Another one, went to bed feeling well, but woke up dead. Primary cause, blow on the head with an axe. Contributory cause, another man's wife. Well, let me share with you a story of a unique revolution. The evening of September 21, 1823, a revolution was announced that would eventually affect every living person or every person who has ever lived upon the earth. The announcement came from a messenger from the presence of God. He said God would send Elijah the prophet before the coming of the Lord with power to turn the hearts of children to their fathers, allowing them to lay claim on the precious promises given to their progenitors. 13.5 years later, Elijah came to Kirtland at the temple there and conferred this revolutionary power and authority upon God's young prophet. The shock waves of this conferment have been reverberating across the world with increasing intensity ever since. Establishing one's genealogical roots was of prime importance among the early Hebrews, but was generally ignored in America until after the coming of Elijah. It's marvelous to see how the Lord has orchestrated prominent people, significant events, and amazing technology to shape a magnificent prism of family history with numerous facets, bringing about a resplendent renaissance of turning hearts to progenitors. Now, I'd like to review a few highlights from history to illustrate. In the first temple authorized by the Lord in America were committed the unique keys of gathering and the sealing ordinances of the priesthood. 4 years later, the prophet astounded a funeral audience with the announcement of the ordinance of baptism for the dead. 20 months later, in May 1842, selected brethren received their endowments of the Melchizedek priesthood from Joseph the prophet. The keys of the priesthood were conferred upon the 12, so that when the prophet was martyred in June 1844, the work would continue. When the Nauvoo Temple was nearly finished, President Young, with Elder Heber C. Kimball and others who held the keys, commenced to confer the endowment upon living members. From December 1845 until February 8, 1846, over 5,000 saints were endowed. Temple ordinances were not performed for the dead in the temple until the St. George Temple was completed in January of 1877. Susie Young Gates, daughter of Brigham Young, was the first to be baptized vicariously in the temple for a progenitor. And President Brigham Young, crippled with rheumatism, was carried from room to room where he received the endowment for his departed father. In 1894, and these are just mountaintop references quickly as I go through this. In 1894, the Genealogical Society of Utah was organized. In that year, President Woodruff announced the revelation on sealings to our own fathers rather than to prominent members of the church. Skipping along, in the 1930s, Elder John A. Witzo, who was a great benefactor of family history, was intrigued by an article in Popular Mechanics magazine on microfilming. And he sent a note to Archibald F. Bennett saying, "I would watch this. Something may come of it." In 1938, a German convert microfilming enthusiast began our formal entry into the intriguing work, which would eventually send 250 cameras all over the industrialized world. We now have over 1.5 million rolls of microfilm containing vital birth, marriage, and death records. It's been estimated that there have been about 70 billion people live upon the earth. There is a record of about 7 billion of those who died before 1900. We have records for about 2.5 billion of those individuals safely stored in the Granite Mountain Vault. One of the explosive events the Lord has used to turn millions of hearts of people to their ancestors was a publication of the book Roots, the dramatic saga of human desire for personal identity. It gripped the hearts of people the world over. It became the bestseller in the United States publishing history. Translated into 30 languages, it sold 6 million copies. A year later, it was televised in a 7-night miniseries that reached an estimated 130 million viewers, the greatest program audience in television history. Just last week, Mr. Haley's final work on his father's family, entitled Queen, was shown on network television. Perhaps some of you were able to see it. Mr. Haley shared an experience that symbolized the most traumatic moments he had while he was writing his book. He'd been working on the section where Kunta Kinte and others were in the hold of a slave ship crossing the ocean. He was in an apartment in San Francisco, but he threw out two batches of about 40 pages that he had written. He said, "It struck me that something was wrong. Here I am in a high-rise, carpeted apartment, writing about him in the hold of a slave ship." He flew to Africa, booked himself as a passenger on a freighter sailing to Florida. As a retired Coast Guardsman, he was successful in arranging to go into the hold of the ship each night after dinner. Stripped down to his underwear, he forced himself to stay in one position on a plank all night long. He listened to the sounds of the ship. He felt the cold. He saw the darkness and wondered what his ancestor must have heard and felt and seen on that dreadful voyage. He came up from the hold each morning and scribbled down his impressions. "The fourth night at sea," he said, "that night, somehow, I just didn't want to go down that hold. It was uncomfortable misery. Instead, I went back on the stern of the ship and stood at the rail. I was just standing there, looking at the white froth that was beat out by the propeller, when all of a sudden," he says, "all my troubles rolled in on me, just like waves. I guess I owed $100,000. I'd been 11 years on this book. I had maybe $300 in assets. All of a sudden," he said, "I had an experience I cannot forget. I began to hear voices. Not big, a simple thing. There were people talking. I heard them say that there was an answer to it. All I had to do was to step through the rail, just step through and drop into the sea. I guess I was a millimeter away from stepping through the rail when I heard other voices, conversational voices, saying, 'No, don't do that. You must finish. You must go on. You've got to finish.' I knew exactly who they were. They were Kunta Kinte and Bell, Chicken George, and my grandmother. All the ancestors I'd been writing about. I remember kind of tearing myself away from the rail, spinning around and scrambling across the hatch covers." Mr. Haley said that night, when he went down into the hold of the ship around midnight, he was emotionally and physically exhausted. "But that night," he said, "was almost like a religious experience. From that night forward, I never had the misgivings, the tortures of thinking how ridiculous the thing I was trying to do was. But I began to think that perhaps I was some kind of a conduit. I felt that my ancestors had considered and approved me, and that I was to go on and try to write. I feel that this book was meant to be. I think that it would be blasphemous for anyone to think he could write a thing like this without the help of the Lord." Now, according to an article in the Congressional Quarterly, Alex Haley's roots is the primary cause of the worldwide surge in interest in family history. You may recall Mr. Haley's moving statement: "In all of us there is a hunger, marrow deep, to know our heritage, to know who we are and where we have come from. Without this enriching knowledge, there is a hollow yearning. No matter what our attainments in life, there is still an emptiness and the most disquieting loneliness." It's been just a year now since Alex Haley's untimely death. A few months before, I was a guest of his at his farm in Norris, Tennessee. As we visited, I said, "Alex, do you have any idea how much impact you and your book have had on people throughout the world?" He answered, "Well, I think so." I said, "Well, I've only been involved in family history administration just a few years, but it seems to me that there's an invisible hand who's guiding this work, bringing people like you and scientific developments and events to move along together on a predetermined course." And he slammed his fist down on his knee, and he said, "That's right." He said, "I felt the guiding hand of the Lord as I wrote my book." Well, how appropriate that just 1 year after the broadcast of Roots, June 1978, the historic revelation was announced that all of the children of God could receive the blessings of the priesthood. Now, another development. The computer has changed our lives, hasn't it? It's also done the same with family history. Elder Henry B. Eyring, who used to preside at this university, in 1959 had a rather unusual experience. He was attending Harvard University at the time, and he was invited to a dinner party with some local businessmen. There he met a representative of the IBM Corporation, who seemed to be in kind of a pensive mood. He was not aware that Hal was a member of the church, but he told him that he had just returned from Salt Lake City, and the most frustrating experience he had ever encountered. He said, "I've met with the officials of the Mormon Church's genealogical organization." He said, "I think I got a sense as to why the computer was invented. I saw rows and rows of huge card files and little old ladies in tennis shoes running up and down the aisles, manually pulling cards of millions of names that were filed there. And I thought if there was ever a natural marriage between the IBM computers, this was it." He says, "You know," he said, "I didn't get the first base of these people." Well, at that time, it'd take a pretty large room to house the gigantic computers of the 1950s. And the cost was astronomical. Today, we have small desktop computers that make it possible for individuals to access information that the big dinosaurs of 40 years ago contained. And they're affordable. Great idea. Timing, not quite ready, a little premature. Even now, when computers are small enough and affordable, we need to be able to transfer the data from the central computer to the small computers in our church building so that the members can access it. Once again, the Lord provided. This little compact disc that makes this possible. Now, you may think this is invented to play rock music, right? But I believe the Lord had something else in mind. This compact disc is the means of publishing computerized information so that the big computers can talk to the little ones. On one of these is recorded the ordnance data for almost 27 million people. 70 of these disks make up our International Genealogical Index, including records from about 150 countries around the world. It's incredible that about 70 of these contain the ordnance data for about 187 million people. And 7 of these disks of the ancestral file contain data for about 12.7 million people, linked together as families, from which you may create family pedigrees and also family group sheets. And there is theoretical mathematics today, just around the corner, in compression technology, that they tell us, time will prove whether or not they're on the right track, but they tell us that they can provide us the compression technology that the data on 100 of these can be compressed to just one disk. Now, this is the kind of experience that we're having and how the Lord is using it. Now, the Lord is turning hearts in other ways as well. We've been cultivating relationships in the USSR for about 30 years in an effort to microfilm vital records. In 1989, one of our associates, Kalyle Mayer, was talking to Dr. Patricia Grinstead of Harvard University regarding the top, regarded as the top scholar on Russian archives. He expressed a strong interest in the churches being able to microfilm public and church records in the Soviet Union. She told Kalyle that in her opinion, the church would never have access to their church and public records in the Russian archives. Well, the Lord thought differently. In April of last year, Sister Clark and I and Lynn Carson, our acquisition manager for Europe, sat down in the former Central Committee of the Communist Party, and I signed a contract with Dr. Rudolf Pikoya, chairman of the Committee of Archival Affairs for the Republic of Russia. This contract authorized the Genealogical Society of Utah to microfilm the church and public records for 200 regional archives in the Republic of Russia. Now, we're now completing satisfactory negotiations with the republics of Ukraine and Belarus. We are also successfully filming in Estonia. Now, the Brethren have authorized 54 cameras to film in the former USSR, now called the Commonwealth of Independent States. Back in 1989, who but the Lord could have foreseen the collapse of the Iron Curtain and the expansion of his work? We're microfilming in all the major countries of the world. Let's talk about America here for a bit. In February 1978, a man and his wife came to the Chickamauga Battlefield site in Tennessee. It's operated by the National Park Service. They submitted the names and units of two Civil War soldiers. One name was the husband's great-grandfather. The other was the great-grandfather of the wife. They wanted to know if they had fought there. And after some tedious research in the park's library, it was determined that the husband's progenitor was a Union soldier and the wife's progenitor was a Confederate soldier. Now, the park attendant wrote, "These soldiers' units had fought each other just 100 yards apart. For 2 days in early autumn, their armies hammered each other in what became the war's bloodiest battle. Yet somehow, these two men survived this battle, as well as 2 more years of fighting. They returned home, married, and had families. 2 more generations followed, and then a grandchild from each family met and married, and on that February day in 1978, we're able to make a connection with the past. Now, we're working with the National Park Service and the Federation of Genealogical Societies and the U.S. National Archives on an exciting indexing project for the Civil War dead. It's estimated by historians that half of all living Americans have relatives who fought in the Civil War. And we have almost 1,300 family history centers throughout the United States and Canada making family search programs available for computer use. Increasingly, wards and stakes all over the church are using these centers to assist members of the church in their family history efforts. About 70% of all of our patrons are what we call community patrons. They do not belong to our church. We invite them to share their research to build our international database. Most are delighted to do so. Many are more diligent and dedicated than our own members. One of my colleagues, Elder Clint Cutler, was on an airplane going to Dallas, and they met a sweet lady who had been in our library for about 3 days. And she told him she had just turned over a copy of her family records to the library. She said, "You know, they're going to include our records in their ancestral file. Just imagine, she said, people that we don't even know are benefiting from my family's records. That's the spirit that we're seeing. Now, people who use our facilities use them for a variety of personal reasons. We're delighted to make them available. We only ask that they share, as they share our facilities, that we expect them to help build our database so that more people, in turn, can benefit by them. Now, you have an excellent family history center here at Ricks College, located at the Special Collections section of the McKay Library. It's equipped with 12 family search computers. It's open 85 hours a week. Now, if you have one finger and at least one eye, and if you have the curiosity to discover your roots, then I urge you to get acquainted with Blaine Bake, the director of your center, and his associates, and see how easy it is to get started. But I warn you, it's contagious and can afflict you with a lifetime malady, which will get you involved in doing good work all your life. Now, there are several family history courses taught through the College of Religion here at Ricks that I'd recommend highly. As you become involved in identifying your roots and linking your families together, you'll feel the spirit of Elijah and you'll be blessed to participate in some of the most truly inspiring miracles that are changing lives and turning hearts. I'd like to refer to a couple of them if I have time. First of all, from the University of Utah Stake, a young man whose name was Cesar Diaz. His father died when he was 12. He's a native of Ecuador. He joined the church when he was 17 against the wishes of his mother. He also served an honorable mission in Washington, D.C., also contrary to her counsel. Since joining the church, he approached his mother several times about extending the blessings of the temple to his deceased father. She emphatically refused each time. His stake set April 19, 1990, as the Temple Ancestor Day. Cesar decided to set a goal to take his father's name through the temple on that day. He and his wife began a regular course of fasting and prayer. However, Cesar could not muster the courage to ask his mother's permission. One Sunday, his bishop encouraged him to call his mother. Cesar again fasted, and at the end of the day, he called. He reticently asked her. Her reply was, "Oh, I think that'd be wonderful." Cesar was shocked and had to ask the second time to make sure that his mother understood what it was he was asking. One day before the appointed day, he called his mother to double check, still amazed by her change of heart. Her reply was, "Cesar, I'm looking forward to this day for your father." And then he knew that all his fasting had been consecrated to the softening of his mother's heart and that his prayers had been heard. Cesar was able to do all of his father's ordinance work on the Temple Ancestor Day. He bears personal witness of how sacred an experience it was and the closeness he felt to his father in performing the ordinances of salvation in his behalf. Another experience that's left an indelible impression in my heart. It occurred when we visited the Utah State Prison. The prison family history program was started about 1988. About 8 inmates were involved. A center was really kind of a dream. But with the vision of the local leaders, seeing a center as a means of rehabilitation, a small center was established in 1990. The number of inmates participating grew to 23, and after a year it increased to 100. 40% of all participating had no former affiliation with the LDS Church. They order an average of 400 films a month since the center was in operation. They had in excess of 23,000 microfiche. 5 extraction programs were operating. We just opened our second center there, which will increase the number participating. They love the computer. The few they have are in great demand. They're paid just 40 cents an hour, and some at that rate have accumulated enough money to be able to purchase an inexpensive laptop. One man trades his commissary merchandise for computer time. A common brotherhood turning hearts to family is developed. Ties with their own families on the outside have strengthened since their involvement in family history. As they have told their own families what they're doing and its effect upon their lives for good, the family members are participating. One man hadn't seen a member of his family for over 30 years. Since he's been active in family history, he's been reunited with his sister, who's helping him in the research. He has personally submitted over 300 names for temple ordinances. Another inmate was incarcerated for a most serious crime. He was excommunicated from the church and disinherited by his father. He was filled with hostility. He was at war with everybody. He instituted 33 lawsuits against the state of Utah and the penal system. He was introduced to family history. He discovered that he was the only member of his parents' family doing anything with family history. He has submitted over 4,000 names for ordinance work and has extended his pedigree to 50,000 names. He ordered a certain film. The film number was one digit off from the one he had ordered it. He decided to look at it anyway. It resulted in 6,000 names from Ireland on his mother's line. Accidental? He doesn't think so. The prison counselor said that this brother has had the bitterness taken from his heart. The Lord has healed his soul, he said. This inmate told of an experience he had one night as he was thinking about his ancestors. Let him tell his own story as he wrote it to a family history consultant. He said, "I'm not a very spiritual person, and I still have my faults. Even so, I just had an experience that's shaken me to the core of my being. It's now 12:50 a.m., and I'm sitting on my bunk. My genealogical data is on my lap. As I recall what I just had occur, at 10 o'clock, I sat up on my bunk and continued cross-referencing my collected genealogical data. After the place had been quiet for about an hour, I began to sense the presence of somebody quite near to me. I could hear my celly snoring in the top bunk. And I was the only other person in our cell. The feeling continued to grow in intensity and depth. I had the distinct feeling of a lot of people in my cell. Getting up, I switched the main light off, leaving the cell nightlight on. I got back in my bunk and bowed my head in prayer, asking the Lord for wisdom and knowledge and strength to continue on my research. Quite slowly, I was overwhelmed by a loving, warm sensation which drained away all my tenseness. I saw dozens of figures of people dressed in all manner of clothing, from flowing gowns with odd crinkled collars, men in knee pants, long pants, colonial clothing, and each was looking at me. As each passed where I sat with legs crossed on my bunk, I heard, "We need you. We need you to find us so we can move on." I'm yet very shaken up. I was fully conscious all the time. Had I gone to sleep, my heavy notebook would have fallen to the ground. This was no dream. I feel like I've been given a charge, or if you will, a mission. This had to have been of the Lord, due to the pervading sense of peace I felt. I had tears all through it, and never have I experienced such a strong feeling of love before. I can't fully put into words what this has done to me. Move on. What's meant by these words? Just whom did I see, and why me? I'm a convict. I'm in prison. I was excommunicated. These kind of things just don't happen to people like me. I feel that for a brief period of time, perhaps the Lord saw my sincerity in seeking my ancestors out, and for that fraction of time, the veil was lifted. I need your continued faithful support if I'm to truly find all those I saw that night. The look in their eyes was haunting, pleading. The inmate who supervises our center is serving a mandatory 50 years to life sentence from two states. Family history is his life's total commitment. It has brought him a sense of purpose, of esteem, of being needed. He's on a lifetime mission of bringing souls to Christ through family history, both inside the Utah State Penitentiary and more especially those who live in the spirit prison through the veil of mortality. He said, I know what it means to wait. Wait for baptism. Wait for someone else to do things for me that I can't do. We can release those prisoners who wait, he said. My young brothers and sisters, I realize that this is perhaps something that you haven't been giving a great deal of thought to. But it's of grave importance to our Heavenly Father. He loves all of His children. Those who live on both sides of the veil, once we come to understand that they are alive also, we come to understand that the mission of the church is to come unto Christ. How about those who can't come? How about those who have been taught the gospel of Jesus Christ, have accepted it, have repented, and yet cannot progress because they're waiting for someone to be baptized for them and to have some of the other ordinance work performed that is necessary for their continued progress. I hope you'll give this some thought. I hope you'll think about who you are. I hope you'll ask yourselves, where are my roots? Maybe they're not slaves, as in the case of Alex Haley, but who are your roots? What does it mean to be part of a family? What does it mean to be sealed together for eternity? All of these questions are so vital. The Lord loves all of His children. A lot of the action today is coming from teenagers and from college-age students who are not afraid of computers, who are able to use these magnificent tools that the Lord has provided us to do the work that used to take so many, many long hours of pick and shovel work. I commend to you a wonderful adventure that you may recognize how the Lord has guided this work to its present state as I bear my testimony to you. This is one of the other great evidences that God is at the helm, that this is His work. In the name of Jesus Christ, amen.